As the civil rights movement of the mid-20th century made its way onto college campuses, the leaders of those institutions needed to find a way to keep the peace while making big changes.
Whenever we saw that sort of racial moment on a college campus, we always turned toward the college president.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear how college presidents straddled the campus color line. We'll also spend an academic minute with Equality on the Links. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Some of America's most pressing civil rights issues, from desegregation, equal educational and employment opportunities, to housing discrimination and free speech, have been closely intertwined with colleges and universities. While college students, politicians, and other activists actively participated in the fight for and against civil rights, the role of college presidents has not adequately been told. Until now. That's the story Eddie R. Cole tells in his new book, The Campus Color Line, College Presidents and the Struggle for Black Freedom. Dr. Cole is an associate professor of higher education and organizational change at the University of California at Los Angeles. I asked him why he took on this project.
Yeah, this is a fascinating project that national in scope. I just wanted to do it because I had so many questions about the contemporary landscape in higher education. As we move from, say, 2011 to 2012, there was the Occupy Wall Street movement, which had a ton of student activism occurring on college campuses. And then by the time we got to 2015, there was the Black student activism picking up national attention from the University of Missouri and quickly spread across the nation during the 2015-2016 academic year. And I was watching these college presidents across the nation try to respond to these contemporary racial incidents. But the demands that students were making, the demands were historical in nature. All the students were saying that there was an issue around climate on campus, whether it was demands against capitalism, demands against racism, and how those two things are related. Ultimately, presidents too often were responding as if this was a one-off contemporary moment. But I want to get back into the history of it. And so I started going back into the Black Freedom Movement and really looking at from the 1940s through the 1960s, how have college presidents really engaged this broader question about race and racism on college campuses and beyond?
And why did you focus particularly on the college presidents?
Yeah, well, it's one of those things that if you were to look at headlines recently, right, if I were to put up a photograph of the University of Virginia in August 2017, you would likely see, the tiki torches marching around campus, and the demands, the media attention went immediately to, well, what did the president know before this rally happened, and how did the college president at UVA respond to it? And oftentimes, whenever we saw that sort of racial moment on a college campuses, we always turn toward the college president, right? And so whether consciously or unconsciously, we've all sort of accepted that the leader of the campus has a responsibility in addressing these issues, right? Even if that leader didn't create the issue, we look toward our leaders on college campuses to address those issues, to rectify the racial climate when it's like that. So I wanted to look at college presidents specifically because, again, whether we know it or not, we've given a lot of credit. We've turned toward those leaders to address our issues.
And in the time frame that you focus on, it's a 40-year period between 1948 and 1968. There weren't too many college presidents of color that you're talking about, are there?
Well, no, not from a national standpoint. No, not necessarily. But the beauty of the book is that at historically black colleges, there were black college presidents leading those institutions. And so the book being national, reaching from the Northeast, coming down to the South, the Upper South and Deep South, across the Midwest and on the West Coast, the book has a phenomenal breadth and reach of the types of institutions, right? We're talking about private and public. We're talking about predominantly white campuses and historically black campuses. And we're also talking about colleges in the South and outside of the South, right? Because this isn't just a Southern issue. And so you do see these numerous instances where there are these white academic leaders leading universities, but they're also in conversation with black college presidents as well in the South.
1948, the entire civil rights movement was budding. Did this change in colleges around the country reflect just what was going on elsewhere around the country?
Yeah, absolutely, right. So the issues at hand, and ultimately what the book argues is, you know, that college presidents were influential actors, even if they did so quietly, in shaping policies and practices that had racial implications in America. And a lot of the issues were tied directly to other issues happening beyond college campuses. And the book has, you know, phenomenal conversations about the role that college presidents played in shaping the federal housing acts that came through the late 40s and through the 1950s, and the role that universities played in housing discrimination, especially in major cities, New York, Philadelphia, Boston area, Chicago. You pick a major city. College presidents were absolutely critical in lobbying before federal officials and having meetings at the White House, particularly with the Eisenhower administration. You see the role that university leaders have played in shaping so many aspects of American societal life. And so it's really, really interesting to think about these academic leaders that way, because they're not simply reacting to social issues, but they're actually proactive in shaping how the nation engages those issues. Looking at how college presidents responded to issues, when I really got into the history of it, is looking at these leaders in a much more broad and much more complex way. You see them as a national collective actively shaping policy around those issues.
You just spoke about housing discrimination. The chapter where you focus on housing discrimination begins with this wonderful quote from Velma Hall. The octopus in the South has tentacles in the North. That's just a wonderful way to get into that chapter.
Yeah, you find some things in the archives that capture, you know, everything that you hope to convey in the book when you're looking at the research. And that quote really captures the entire book, not just that chapter, right? It's just beautiful in the sense that, yeah, these issues that, you know, our national collective memory, if you will, tends to reflect on the civil rights movement and limit our thoughts primarily to the South, right? There are phenomenal historians who have pushed back on that and talked about the Jim Crow North as well. But especially when it comes to higher education and the role of our colleges and universities, when it comes to civil rights and unrest. And an important takeaway, imagining how when federal officials have a national issue, they tend to look toward colleges and universities because these are the places that are intended to solve our nation's problems. And specifically, they oftentimes look toward college presidents because those are the individuals who lead the institutions that are supposed to solve our nation's problems.
You have stories in here about some fascinating characters. And one that I really hooked on was John Davis Williams, who was the chancellor at Ole Miss starting in 1946. Talk about that, the search for him and just the amazing changes the university went through while he was there.
Yeah, so John Davis Williams, J.D. Williams, as his closest friends call him, becomes the chancellor at Ole Miss in 1946. And the hiring process for him is so fascinating, right? So just a brief background on the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss, as it's called. Coming through the 1920s and 1930s, largely the institution's history was focused on maintaining the social hierarchy in that state. Obviously, it's segregated, it's all white, it's heavily male at that point. And it's just about, you know, grooming the next generation of the sons of Mississippi, if you will. But ultimately, what you see coming into the 1940s is this sort of national pressure around what is our institution going to become? And there's this conflict on campus around, do we stay focused on becoming sort of a Southern social club, or is the university going to become serious academic institution so it can compete across the region and nationally with his fellow academic institutions? And so the search for J.D. Williams becomes really fascinating because the Board of Trustees, they're very interested in looking for a Southerner, preferably a Mississippian. And so J.D. Williams is born in Kentucky, just across the Ohio River from Cincinnati, spends most of his career in Kentucky. I mean, eventually moves up to becoming the president of Marshall University, at the time Marshall College. And while at Marshall, while president of Marshall from 1942 to 46, he actually engages a few of these, what they call interracial programs by some of these national consortium, which is unheard of. So the process of hiring him is one of those things where he does his delicate dance. The trustees are like, do we like this person? Do we not like this person? Is he Southern enough to lead the University of Mississippi? And so it becomes just this fascinating process to hire him. But he does a phenomenal job in building up that university in terms of physical infrastructure. The book talks about how many acres and how many more square feet and how many more buildings are built during his tenure. And ultimately, he's good at building up the university, but he tends to take a back seat when it comes to the broader question around desegregation. And that's where the book really gets into his leadership after the riot on campus in September 62, when James Meredith enrolled as the first Black student. J.D. Williams really steps into the national spotlight and showing how an institution can recover its public image after having a racial riot on campus.
He really just walked a tightrope between the segregationists and the integration and James Meredith himself. And after the riot, he really did keep it together, didn't he?
He didn't rock the boat too much one side or the other. And obviously being the college president, it's important to almost think of them as elected officials because they answer to so many different stakeholders. And J.D. Williams was no different, right? You have to imagine how he was in conversation with Ross Barnett, white supremacist, segregationist governor of Mississippi, but also, in conversation in a legal battle against the NAACP and James Meredith trying to desegregate the university and trying to walk that tightrope. It wasn't so simple as a president did or did not do something. It's much more complex than that.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Eddie Cole continues with a look at another Southern state and another Southern college president. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Dr. Eddie R. Cole, and we're talking about his new book called The Campus Color Line, College Presidents and the Struggle for Black Freedom. We just heard the story of how Ole Miss was finally integrated, and now we're heading next door to Alabama to hear how a man named Frank Rose was able to broker a deal that peacefully brought students of color to Clemson.
Yeah, so Frank Rose is the president of the University of Alabama, and that's a perfect question segue from thinking about J.D. Williams at Ole Miss. Frank Rose also was very closely watching how events unfolded in 1962 at Ole Miss because he was leading the University of Alabama. And when he was hired in the late 1950s, one of his responsibilities was to, when the desegregation question comes back to Alabama, because they had, I would call, a failed desegregation attempt in 1956 due to racist pushback. But ultimately, when the question came back to Alabama after Ole Miss, how could he lead the university to do so peacefully and without violence? And so in early 1963, Clemson College, now Clemson University, peacefully desegregates and admits Harvey Gantt, who goes on to eventually become the mayor of Charlotte, North Carolina. And Harvey Gantt, being the first Black student at Clemson and enrolled without federal marshals and without, you know, smoke everywhere and gunfire, it's just a peaceful enrollment. Frank Rose actually coordinates a team of influential businessmen in Alabama and reaches out to Robert Edwards, who's the president at Clemson, and has that team of influential leaders in Alabama fly to South Carolina to have this sort of quiet meeting with Clemson officials to figure out, how did you do it? That meeting leads to the University of Alabama having a very detailed strategy on how to desegregate peacefully, despite George Wallace, despite the international media attention and everyone being in Tuscaloosa on that campus in June 1963. Ultimately, there's no violence on campus. And that's largely due to Frank Rose and his sophisticated coordination of local law enforcement, federal officials, including the Kennedys in Washington, D.C., being in constant communication with Governor Wallace, also like Ross Barnett, a segregationist, as well as notably being in contact with the Black students and their representatives who are about to enroll at the university. So, I mean, talk about a lot of moving parts. And Frank Rose, again, becomes just this fascinating figure and navigating so many different stakeholders, so many different personalities while the world is watching.
And of course, we did mention this was not a Southern problem. This was a national thing. So let's talk about one more college president, a University of Wisconsin president, Fred Harrington. What did he do up there? And there was one quote from him, by the way, and this seemed in retrospect a little naive, where he thought, I'm just going to paraphrase, he thought that integration would wipe out the label predominantly Black forever. Didn't quite work out that way for him, did it?
No, not at all, right? And so Fred Harrington, president of University of Wisconsin up in Madison, also is grappling with the race question, as all college presidents are across the nation. And ultimately, the chapter that's focused on him wraps up the book, and it really pushes us toward a few things to think about in a contemporary moment. But Fred Harrington at Wisconsin ultimately answers the call from President Kennedy in July, the summer of 63. And Kennedy has turned to these academic leaders and says, ultimately, you're the best and brightest. You're the smartest people in our nation. Help us truly solve this racial problem and racial inequities in America. A number of these programs end up being launched on college campuses to figure out how to do so. And you find presidents of white universities like President Harrington, as well as presidents of numerous Black colleges as well, start working together. And these programs have a number of partnerships and cultural exchange programs. And most of these programs are geared toward historically Black colleges. And one notable program is launched on predominantly white colleges, and that's race-conscious admissions practices. And ultimately, what we see through Fred Harrington is the beginning of affirmative action programs in higher education. And Fred Harrington truly believed that the answer really resided with predominantly white institutions like Wisconsin and Michigan and University of Chicago and those types of places, not historically Black colleges in the South. And ultimately, there becomes quite a tension between Black colleges and large, predominantly white research universities in the Northeast, across the Midwest, and so forth. And so President Harrington really thought that the label predominantly Black college, which is now a historically Black college, would no longer be needed. And that was far from the case, as we see they still exist today, and they're still quite viable institutions today and will continue to be for years and years to come. So it just shows that how even some of these college presidents had their own notions of where things would go and how things would change. And frankly, they were wrong. But, you know, it's quite a complex time in history, and the origins of affirmative action in higher education and how college presidents were behind these initial programs is quite telling. It's quite a fascinating history.
And you say that those first affirmative action programs led the white universities to start raiding the HBCUs for talent.
Fred Harrington at Wisconsin actually actively starts recruiting Samuel Proctor a famed civil rights leader and Southern minister and president of multiple historically black colleges. But at the time, he was the president of North Carolina A&T in Greensboro, which is, you know, notable for having four students involved with the lunch counter sit-ins that really sparked movement throughout the South in 1960. And you can just imagine, you know, Fred Harrington trying to recruit another college president to come to Wisconsin, not to be his number two, but actually to lead a special center, a human rights institute on the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee campus. So not even, you know, the flagship, the main campus right there in Madison. And so you just see just his perception of the value of black colleges. He saw the talent there, obviously, but he didn't really see it as best served on black campuses. And, you know, that history, that story right there leads to a number of questions that we can ask today about how do we think of certain institutions as being the authority, being the place where we have the answers for society's problems coming from, as opposed to can we really be more satisfied and instead imagine a higher education system where all institutions are equally respected as toward having meaningful contributions to the nation.
One thing you talk about, and it went on then and it's still going on now, is college presidents trying to juggle free speech on campus. It just, that's never going to go away, is it?
No, we're going to be dealing with that one for quite some time, right? And there's this thin line between free speech and hate speech. But free speech, you know, I focus on an issue before the free speech movement of 1964. And I think that's most critical to understand is that most times when we think of free speech and student unrest, historically, we think of Berkeley in 64. But I focused on Princeton University, actually, through the 1950s and into the early 60s, when a student organization actually invited Ross Barnett, who I mentioned previously, the governor of Mississippi, to speak at Princeton University. And Princeton becomes a very fascinating place because historically, Princeton has a very Southern reputation in the sense that during the Civil War, half of the student body at Princeton was actually from Southern states. Princeton had a very rich culture, lots of links to the South, and very much functioned, even though it's in New Jersey, very much functioned in a lot of ways culturally as a Southern white institution. And so there's a tension for Robert Goheen, who's the president at Princeton at the time, between catering toward longtime multi-generational alumni from Southern states who largely support someone like Ross Barnett, alongside what's happening in the 1960s with the civil rights push and Princeton asking serious questions about what can it do as a university to address racial issues and, frankly, enroll more Black students. Now, you can imagine, just like today, when you have a white supremacist, you know, someone spewing out racist rhetoric on campus in the speech, while also trying to say that you're a diverse and welcoming institution, it doesn't quite line up. And so this historical moment at Princeton dealing with free speech is quite telling. And the lesson learned from the discussion in the book is just how Princeton was able to use that particular speech, the particular moment from Ross Barnett, to actually implement initiatives that truly address racism and racial issues, not only on the Princeton campus, but also in the Princeton township.
Well, finally, what are the visionary college presidents of today dealing with?
You know, the short answer will be everything discussed in the book. You know, college presidents today are still dealing with free speech, right? You know, where's the line between having a controversial speaker on campus versus trying to actively recruit and maintain a racially and ethnically diverse student body? I mean, that remains an issue today. Housing discrimination, right? As universities physically get larger and physically expand and drive up the price, the cost of living, what is the relationship between these institutions, which should be committed to bettering the community alongside the issue of pricing out and driving longtime residents out of homes that they are no longer able to afford? The same questions around affirmative action. We see right now we have a federal court case against Harvard University, another one soon coming against Yale and Princeton has federal attention against it as well. Your most selective universities remain at the heart of the conversation around affirmative action in higher education. So all of those issues discussed in the book, I mean, you know, who gets to go to what colleges and why, free speech, housing discrimination, affirmative action, historically black colleges and their challenges, their place within the national higher education landscape, all of those questions that we're asking today are covered historically in the book. And so the issues have not changed largely for today's college presidents.
Again, the name of Dr. Eddie Cole's new book is The Campus Color Line, College Presidents and the Struggle for Black Freedom. The fight for equality in the mid-20th century didn't stop on the college campus. It was a wedge issue just about everywhere. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The first desegregation battle in Atlanta was fought in an unusual place. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Lane Demas, professor of history at Central Michigan University, explores where the fight took place.
In December of 1955, Dr. Hamilton Holmes and his son, Alfred, were brimming with excitement. They had just prevailed before the U.S. Supreme Court in the case of Holmes versus Atlanta, the first example of court-ordered desegregation in Georgia's modern history. Yet the excitement within the Holmes household and other black families in Atlanta was tempered by a fear of white retaliation, fueled by anonymous threatening phone calls and talk of violence against the family. Remarkably, that tension centered not on racial segregation in Atlanta's public schools or voting booths, but rather on its golf courses. Holmes versus Atlanta forced the city to allow African Americans access to its public links. Moreover, Hamilton and Alfred's fight against segregation in that seemingly sedate world of middle-class leisure was much more than a curious sidelight to the quest for civil rights in schools, churches, and businesses. In fact, it was intricately tied to that narrative. 3 weeks earlier, Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. had launched the Montgomery bus boycott in Alabama. 6 years later, Alfred's son became one of the first two black students to attend the University of Georgia. Holmes versus Atlanta was the most visible golf integration lawsuit, but others were fought nationwide, at least 28 significant cases from 1941 to 1969 alone. Like the Holmes family, everyday black golfers around the country used the game and its symbolism to shape their communities and the struggle for civil rights. Meanwhile, elite African American players also influenced the professional game, from John Shippen, who nearly won the 1896 U.S. Open, to Tiger Woods. Contrary to popular memory, African Americans have played a major role in the history of golf in America.
That was Lane Demas of Central Michigan University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.